Yes, thanks for joining us.
Iran's leader says the West, including the U.S., was seeking the collapse of the Islamic Republic by backing the former Iraqi dictator during his war on the Iranian nation. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said all world powers assisted Saddam Hussein to wage the war. He said that France and Germany had provided Saddam with the most advanced weapons. The leader underlined that certain Arab states also helped the former Iraqi regime with financial aid and logistics. He said Iranian families sacrificed their sons and daughters to defend their beloved country. But the leader added that the war made Iran stronger as the country succeeded in promoting the culture of resistance. He noted that Iran's active presence in West Asia has been frightening the U.S., its allies, and puppets. Ayatollah Khamenei was addressing a group of veterans and activists of the Iran-Iraq war and resistance ahead of the Sacred Defense Week. Iran's president has delivered his speech at the 78th session of the UN General Assembly. Ebrahim Raisi says that a new world order is taking shape across the globe, which will remain irreversible.
We are at a determining juncture, a historic juncture. Today, the world is moving towards an emerging world, and this trend, this path, is not reversible. The aging liberal order, which serves the interests of domineering powers, which used to serve their interests, it does not exist anymore. And in one word, the project to Americanize the world has failed. The Iranian nation
is. Raisi said the world will not accept the Western hegemony any longer. The Iranian president said some Western powers have the Cold War mentality, fan the flames of conflict, and seek to undermine the well-being of other nations. He said that Iran has played a key role in foiling the plots of hegemonic powers. Raisi further said the presence of foreign forces in West Asia creates insecurity. He described the Israeli regime as the main source of instability and insecurity in the region. The president also hailed anti-terror efforts of the late Iranian commander, General Qasem Soleimani, who was assassinated in a U.S. drone strike in Iraq in January 2020.
The security today for some countries in our region, they owe their security to the struggles by martyr Soleimani. And if it hadn't been for the bravery of Lieutenant General Soleimani, he was a hero of fighting terrorism. If it hadn't been for his struggles, many regions would have burned in the fire set by the Daesh terrorist group.
Raisi said that Iran will use all the capacities at its disposal to bring to justice those who were involved in General Soleimani's assassination. He also blamed Western countries for using terrorism as a tool to advance their foreign policy goals. Raisi said some European countries have become a safe haven for anti-Tehran terror groups like the MKO, which has killed more than 17,000 Iranians. He also condemned the desecration of the Holy Quran and Islamophobia in Europe. The Iranian president also stressed that Iran will not give up its right to use peaceful nuclear technology.
Nuclear weapons have no place in Iran's defense doctrine. Official reports by relevant international authorities as well as Western intelligence agencies, they have time and again actually confirmed this claim, the authenticity of this claim. Iran, over the past two decades, has never ever given up its right to use and will never give up its right to use nuclear technology for peaceful purposes.
The Iranian president played down the impact of U.S. sanctions on the country's progress, highlighting the failure of the maximum pressure campaign launched by the former U.S. administration against Tehran. Raisi also warned Europe will be a loser if it opts for the path of confrontation in dealing with the Islamic Republic over its nuclear case. John Ross is a senior fellow at Chongyang Institute, Renmin University of China. He argues that the Western hegemony is on the decline, even in terms of the economy, as a new world order is emerging.
Two processes which are taking place.
one of which is, as regards its weight within the world economy, the United States has been in decline for, in real terms, for, you know, 50 years, and that's not going to, hasn't changed. Even the IMF, which is, can't be accused of being anti-US, projects that the main driving forces of the global economy in the next period will be in the global south. The dangers of, in the situation, however, is, as I said, the United States will try to reverse this by military means, and also it's carrying out various sanctions, technology boycotts, and other things of that type. Therefore, when looked at the two de-dollarization, there's two real processes. One is it's becoming increasingly urgent for a large number of countries to find a way of getting round the various sanctions carried out by the US on the dollar. And that's why you've seen all sorts of things on this. Iran is getting able to get around these sanctions. Argentina recently took a loan from the from China in RMB in order to avoid having to use the dollar, etc. The second is the question of and that is very, very important. The question of general de-dollarization, I would like to say that that's going to happen, but I don't think it's going to happen in the short term. But an increasing range of countries are going to be will find ways to get around the U.S. sanctions.
Iran's defense minister says Tehran and Moscow have seen an unprecedented expansion in their defense and security ties over the past decade. Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Ashtiani said that cooperation between the two countries will lead to peace and stability in the international arena. Ashtiani also pointed out significant changes in the world order. The top defense official made the remarks during a meeting with his Russian counterpart, Sergei Shoigu. For his part, the Russian defense chief noted that Moscow-Tehran cooperation is reaching new highs despite sanctions. He also stated Russia's preparation to take further joint steps to strengthen stability and security in West Asia. Shoigu arrived in the Iranian capital earlier on Tuesday for talks with senior Iranian officials. The prisoner swap deal between the U.S. and Iran has taken place. Five prisoners from each country has been freed. That is the only common denominator when it comes to this release. While Iran has found it to be its duty to defend the rights of its citizens on humanitarian grounds, the U.S. has blasted Iran as being a bad actor. An emotional reunion. Two of the five Iranians illegally detained by the U.S. have returned to the Islamic Republic, their homeland, reunited with their family. The crime? Conducting business, which the U.S. claimed had violated U.S. sanctions. Meanwhile, the five prisoners held in Iranian jails have also been freed. Their crime, far more serious than just conducting business. They were charged with spying. The Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi and his team conducted very difficult behind-the-scenes talks, an arduous task since Iran and the U.S. cannot negotiate directly. Thanks to mediators in Qatar and in Oman, the release has taken place. This was deemed as a great accomplishment for the Raisi administration on humanitarian grounds. The Iranian president has promised that it would safeguard Iranians' rights and fight for Iran's rights at any cost. Incredible double standards are at play in the way Western media covered this story. It seems like the media forgot that the U.S. had imprisoned Iranians, illegally at that, in their prisons, emotionally covering the released prisoners from Iran, while condemning Iran and its officials. Not even scant coverage of the prisoners of the bereaved families on the Iranian side. One of the prisoners held by Iran on spying charges, Siamak Namazi, was a businessman held since 2015. He thanked the U.S. President Joe Biden for ultimately putting the lives of American citizens above politics, as if the Iranian president had not done that. But the politics Namazi is talking about is out of U.S.'s own doing. The sanctions-obsessed U.S. uses its sanctions policy to twist the arm of nations into following its foreign policy line. Even on the day of the prisoner release, U.S. sanctioned the former president of Iran, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. He was Iran's president 10 years ago. Additionally, the U.S. sanctioned Iran's intelligence ministry, and just days before that, it had sanctioned 29 individuals and entities in connection with what it claimed was violent suppression of nationwide protest, including Press TV.
In the case of Siamak Namazi, he was sentenced to 10 years in prison for espionage and cooperation with the U.S. government and foreign intelligence networks. His company, Atiyeh Bahar Consulting in Tehran, was associated covertly, acting with the U.S. government's companies anti-Iranian in nature, like the VOA TV channel, the U.S. government's Institute for National Strategic Studies, INSS, at the Pentagon's National Defense University, and the Office of Iranian Affairs at the U.S. State Department.
There is a stark contrast to how Iran views diplomacy as opposed to the U.S. Putting aside the vast mistrust between the two, Iran respects the sovereignty of other countries. While the U.S. jails Iranians because of alleged circumvention of illegal U.S. sanctions, Iran justifiably jails people suspected of spying and collaborating with foreign governments like the U.S.
The Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi is in New York for the yearly UN General Assembly meeting. His spokesman said the message of Iranian President to the world is, quote, peace, justice, confronting discrimination and domination, unilateralism and terrorism, and the West supporting terrorist groups, the main messages of the Iranian nation. True to his word, since he came to power, the Iranian president has fast-tracked Iran's relations with a host of nations, extending his hand of friendship and peace to leaders from Latin America to Africa to West Asia and to the East with Asian countries. Yet the U.S. has described this government as what it calls a rogue terrorist regime. Question is, has Iran done anything to fit that description? Does Iran go and confiscate the earnings of another nation, forcing the country that has those funds to hold it hostage? Or does Iran go and confiscate another country's oil tanker at sea, which in essence is a form of piracy? In this case, the U.S. reason? It was a sanctions enforcement operation. These types of sanction-driven acts, however, have come back to haunt the U.S., along with its allies, like its European partners. Countries have realized that it is not Iran that has rogue elements, but the U.S. The sanctions regime, the weaponization of the dollar, and its foreign policy agenda has left the U.S. isolated on the international stage. Organizations like BRICS and the SCO are testament to that. Countries are rejecting the U.S. approach and are aligning themselves with each other. Some of the U.S. and Western media are accusing Iran of executing a hostage and ransom act. This line doesn't have many buyers, especially when it comes to the topic of prisoners. A country that has the most number of prisoners inside its jails cannot accuse another country like Iran of being rogue, never mind the illegal torture that takes place there. The U.S. also has no credibility when it supports a regime like Israel, which detains and jails people without charge or trial, almost on a daily basis. This is while Iran inside the country has pardoned thousands of prisoners on a yearly basis based on Iran's leader discretion and approval. So the Western hostage and ransom narratives against Iran doesn't hold ground. Western pundits and so-called rights groups fail to mention Iranians languishing in U.S. prisons. They accuse Iran of falsifying charges against prisoners, like spying charges. Maybe the U.S. needs to be reminded how it was spying on Iran on a massive scale during the time it had an embassy in Iran. But the U.S. doesn't learn its lessons and continues down a path of failed maximum pressure campaign, a failure admitted by U.S. officials. This is why Iran will continue down its path of imprisoning anyone suspected of spying and acting against Iran's national security, as it has done countless number of times.
Azerbaijan's defense ministry has confirmed a ceasefire with ethnic Armenian forces in the Nagorno-Karabakh. This is a day after Baku launched a military operation in the disputed region.
An agreement was reached on the suspension of local anti-terrorist measures. The units of the Armenian armed forces located in the Karabakh region of the Republic of Azerbaijan. The illegal Armenian armed groups lay down their weapons, leave their combat positions and military posts, and are completely disarmed. Units of the Armenian armed forces leave the territories of Azerbaijan. Illegal Armenian armed groups are released.
Baku had already announced reaching a truce brokered by Russian peacekeepers. The warring sides have agreed to hold talks on reintegrating the breakaway territory into the rest of Azerbaijan on Thursday. In the meantime, the Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan says that Yerevan was not aware of and involved in preparing the text of the ceasefire deal. More than 30 people were killed and over 200 wounded in less than 24 hours of what Azerbaijan called anti-terrorist measures. The Nagorno-Karabakh region is populated mainly by Armenians, but it is an internationally recognized part of Azerbaijan. The latest flare-up came 3 years after Azerbaijan recaptured large parts of the contested territory in a 2020 war that left some 7,000 people dead. Political analyst Rodney Martin believes the U.S. and British spy agencies are involved in the latest tensions between Azerbaijan and Armenia over the Nagorno-Karabakh region.
Well, I'm a little suspicious. If there's no weapons or bombs or mines or armaments in the area, then where do these explosions come from? Mm. I do find the timing of this terrorism to be somewhat suspect, given the West's desire to create as much trouble for Russia as possible, and could be using pawns, or need I say, I kind of smell the handprints of CIA or British MI6 here, trying to cause a regional conflict to try to divide Russia's relationships, which they have very good relations with both countries. So I'm suspicious of this. I don't buy the concept that there's no military targets or there's no armaments in the area, because obviously they are.
As Ukraine continues to strike Crimea increasingly with NATO-supplied weapons and intelligence, Johnny Miller reports from the peninsula and finds many that are concerned that strikes could lead to greater escalation.
Over recent months, Ukraine has been increasing strikes on Crimea. NATO is supplying weapons and intelligence. In turn, many Russians see this as a red line and are calling for harsher retaliation. Many fear strikes in Crimea could lead to a dangerous escalation. The scenic grounds of the Levadia Palace in Yalta. It's here that the leaders of Britain, the US, and USSR met towards the end of the Second World War in order to shape the future peace.
When Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin were here in this palace discussing the future, their aim was to prevent any possible war in the future, never to repeat this horror called the Second World War. And now there is an idea to promote the Third World War, which should never be realized. Most Crimeans are Russian deep in their soul.
Just as peace in the last World War was outlined here, so another wider war is being risked over Crimea. It's thought that in the recent major strike on Sevastopol, missiles directly supplied by a NATO country were used. NATO politicians and the Ukrainian government continue to say that Crimea is Ukraine. Russia, of course, took control of the peninsula in 2014. But the inconvenient truth is that the vast majority of Crimeans want to be part of Russia.
I worry because if there's a strike in Sevastopol, then they could strike Yalta as well. I want Russia to be here. Crimea is Russia. We live a more comfortable life here as part of Russia. Because in Ukraine, our language rights were infringed. Our civil rights were infringed because we are all Russian-speaking population.
It's a big plus that we entered Russia. A lot was done for Crimea. They repaired a lot of roads, hospitals, and schools. That's a big plus. You could never see it in Ukraine. Take Sevastopol Highway. Earlier, it was never repaired. In Levadia, the local hospital was in a dreary state. But now we are satisfied with the way it looks.
NATO-backed strikes on Crimea are expected to increase, along with them the risk of a dangerous escalation. This despite the fact that the vast majority of people living in this scenic paradise just want peace. Johnny Miller, Crimea.
Britain's National Health Service is facing chaos as consultants and junior doctors stage a strike together for the first time. Senior doctors, known as consultants, began a two-day strike on Tuesday over an ongoing pay dispute. Their junior colleagues have now joined the industrial action and would walk off the job until Friday. Consultants demand about a 12% pay hike this year, double the amount the government had offered. The industrial action seriously disrupts services, with thousands of appointments and operations being canceled and rescheduled. The government said that it was considering forcing some healthcare staff to work in hospitals during the strike. The doctors are due to hold 3 days of joint strike action next month. Britain has been rocked by months of nationwide strikes, with government employees in all sectors demanding higher wages in line with rising inflation. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم نیست.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran. Quran.
کتاب الله.
In the limelight.
In the United States, auto industry strike continues as United Auto Workers Chief Sean Fain demands a fair share in negotiations with Detroit's big three automakers. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. America's national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. The auto workers' strike against Detroit's big three automakers went into its fourth day on Monday, 18th of September, with no signs of an early breakthrough and against the threat that the walkout could soon spread. A spokesman for General Motors said, representatives of the company and the United Auto Workers were continuing to negotiate on Monday, 18th of September. So far, the strike is limited to about 13,000 workers at three factories, one each at General Motors, Ford Motors, and Stellantis. General Motors warned, however, that 2,000 United Auto Workers represented workers at an assembly plant in Kansas City, Missouri, are expected to be idled as soon as early this week because of a shortage of supplies from a General Motors plant near St. Louis, where workers walked off their job on Friday, 15th of September. Workers at the Kansas City plant built the Chevrolet Malibu and the Cadillac XT4. Ford Motors on Friday moved to temporarily lay off 600 non-striking workers at its assembly plant in Wayne, Michigan, only hours after other employees at the facility had walked off their jobs. This layoff is a consequence of the strike at Michigan Assembly Plant's final assembly and paint departments, because the components built by these 600 employees use materials that must be E-coated for protection, the company said in a statement on Friday, 15th of September. E-coating is completed in the paint department, which is now on strike. America's Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said she is hoping for a quick resolution, and that is too soon to gauge the impact of the strike. Janet Yellen, in an interview with CNBC, said it's premature to be making forecasts about what it means for the economy. It would depend on how long the strike lasts and who would be affected by it. Experts say the strike could drive up new and used car prices in the United States and cause a loss of $5.6 billion in wages and automaker earnings. In a sign of the potential economic and political ramifications of a long strike, President Joe Biden is sending two top administration officials to Detroit, Michigan this week to meet with both sides. Joe Biden has sided with the United Auto Workers in brief public comments, saying that the automakers have not fairly shared their record profits with their workers. An administration official said on Monday, 18th of September, that Acting Labor Secretary Julie Hsu and senior aide Gene Sperling will not serve as mediators. They won't be at the bargaining table, but are going to Detroit to help support the negotiations in any way the parties feel is constructive. The official was not authorized to discuss private discussions and spoke anonymously. United Auto Workers President Sean Fain on Sunday shut down an offer by Stellantis, which owns Chrysler, Dodge, Jeep and Ram, along with major foreign brands including Citroën, Peugeot and Maserati, to hike its workers' wages by 21% over the next 4 years. Ford Motors and General Motors have also each offered a roughly 20% pay bump. The union is asking for a 36% pay rise over a 4-year contract. The union also wants the big three automakers to eliminate their 2-tier wage model, which results in many workers earning less than the average wage of $32 an hour. Offer defined benefit pensions to all employees, limit the use of temporary workers, offer a 4-day work week, and provide more job protections, including the right to strike over plant closings. Our demands are just, Sean Fain said on Face the Nation program. We're asking for our fair share in this economy and the fruits of our own labor. Rather than launching an all-out strike of its 146,000 members, the union opted to target three factories, a plan that could make the union's $825 million strike fund last longer. Workers walked out at a General Motors plant in Wentzville, Missouri, a Ford plant near Detroit, Michigan, and a Stellantis factory in Toledo, Ohio, that produces Jeeps. A key feature of the United Auto Workers strategy is a threat of escalating the strike if the union is unhappy with the pace of the bargaining. On Friday, 15th of September, Sean Fain said more factories could be targeted. He added, it could be in a day's time or it could be in a week's time.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا O you who believe, اِسْتَعِينُوا بِالصَّبْرِ وَالصَّلَاةِ
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now let's listen to Sheikh Salim Bimji.
Tonight, as we continue in this series of this pure life, this Islamic life, I want to take our minds and our discussion to the next level and look at a topic which is really the foundational block of this religion of Islam. And that is about Tawheed, what we would very, very roughly translate as monotheism, the oneness of God. You know, if you ask anybody, even a non-Muslim, for example, hopefully they would know the minimal about Islam. And if you were to ask them what is the minimal basis that the religion is founded on, they would say, well, you are part of the Abrahamic family. You believe in one God. You know, Allah is your God, as they would say. And yes, they would be right. But the question which we want to look at today and answer is that what is the definition of Tawheed? What is monotheism? Again, as a very rough translation of it, we all claim to be muwahids, ones who believe in the oneness of God. But how deep have we taken the concept of Tawheed? How far have we allowed this to permeate our lives? How far have we allowed the Tawheed, which is explained by the Quran, which has been explained by the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them, and that has been explained by our beloved Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam, into our lives? Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. One of the first things that we have to ask ourselves, and our people would be asking, is that what is the goal of this life? Were we born, as the Quran says, that there are some people who say we were born, we live, we die, and that's all there is? Is that all there is to the life of this world? Is that just we're here for a couple of years to enjoy ourselves, to go through the motions, and then we end, and then there is nothing that comes after this world? What happens when we are faced with difficulties and challenges in our lives? For those who don't believe in a supreme being, in a higher being, in a God, what happens when they are faced with challenges? Where do they go? Where do they turn? Where do we turn? And even maybe worse than that is, if this life is all about attaining stuff, material things, what happens when we reach and we get to that level of making it in this world? When we have everything that we hoped to get, then what happens with the life? What is the meaning of life? What is the purpose of life? And so we recognize that there is something greater in life than just this material world. There is something which needs to drive us, to give us purpose, why we wake up every morning, why we go to school, why we go to work, why we do what we do. And that thing is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, our creator. You know, tonight in this discussion about Tawheed, I want to try and look at it from a different perspective. But you know, when you look at the Quran, you see that Allah has devoted at least one third of the Quran to Him alone. You know, you look at the Quran, there are roughly 6,236 ayat, give or take. Scholars differ on the exact number of verses, because some will not count the repetitive verses that are repeated in word. Some will not count the Bismillah, some will, you know, count in different ways, but more or less around 6,300 verses. One third of the Quran is about the Day of Judgment, the end of this world. So one third is just about Yawmul Qiyamah. There are other ayat about ahkam, about the jurisprudence, anywhere from 300 to 500 verses on praying, fasting, hajj, zakat, khums, marriage, divorce, and so on and so forth. Only 300 verses or 500, that's a small amount. Are there stories of the past prophets? But one third of the Quran is about God, about Allah. Right? For us to be able to recognize, to the limits of our God-given ability, who God is, we will never get to a true understanding of God, of what He truly is, because our minds cannot comprehend and fathom that. But Allah has done His level best in the Quran to give us a clear explanation of who He is and also who He isn't. You know, and so one of the famous verses of the Quran, which I'll begin with, is from Surah Al-Ikhlas, the chapter of sincerity. And I'm sure we've all memorized this because it is one that we read in our salat every day, I'm sure. It's highly recommended to recite this chapter every day in our prayers. In fact, the hadith of the Prophet and Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them, tell us that if you go one day praying your 5 daily prayers, your Fajr, Dhuhr, Asr, Maghrib, and Isha, and you don't recite Surah Al-Ikhlas, you have basically not been fair to Allah. You've not been fair to the Quran. Hadith say you are not counted as being amongst the Musalleen, as those who engage in Salat. So at least once in one of your 5 daily prayers, Surah Al-Ikhlas should be there. It's also mentioned in the Hadith that it is equivalent to 1/3 of the Quran. And scholars suppose that maybe this is the fact because, as I said, 1/3 of the Quran is about Tawheed. And so this chapter is worth 1/3 of the Quran because it is all about the oneness of Allah. The very first verse after the Bismillah is Kul Huwallahu Ahad, where Allah tells Rasulullah, our beloved Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam, Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. He says to the Prophet, say to the people, say that He is God the One, that He is Allah the One, Ahad. You know, now even this word, Ahad, there is such a debate amongst the theologians and the philosophers of Islam that what does it mean, Ahad? If you look at commentators such as Ayatollah Nasser Makarim in his Tafsir Namuna, he goes through about 4 or 5 pages just looking at the word Ahad. Does it differ from Wahid in Arabic? Because both are translated as one. Is Ahad, what does it mean? He quotes a hadith from many imams to look at the definition of Ahad. Is it the same as one in terms of a numerical sense, or is it something different? I won't go into all the specifics. But basically, this verse in itself, although it's only 4 words, Kul huwa Allahu an Ahad, but scholars have written, maybe not volumes, but tens of pages on what does each and every word in this verse mean. In fact, even some of our ulama have taken the word huwa, Kul huwa Allahu Ahad, the ha and the wow, and have gone into explaining what does the ha mean. What does the wow mean? How do these 2 letters go back to the oneness of Allah? So it's not as easy as saying, say that He is God the One. It's a much deeper discussion. And obviously tonight we will just scratch the surface of the Tawheed of Allah. But as I said, that life is not just about a race to have more stuff, to get to, you know, the end of life with the most things. It's not as this material world we live in tells us that the person with the most toys at the end wins the game. No, it's something deeper than that, brothers and sisters.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
روحي كريم عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صل عليه. We'll be right back.
follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
The hunt is on for survivors after at least six people died when a boat sank in the English Channel on Saturday, 12th of August. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Observer has covered this story and tells us more. The government's controversial asylum policy faced renewed criticism on Saturday, 12th of August, when at least six people died after a small boat crossing the English Channel capsized and sank. Another two people are still believed to be missing after the sinking of the boat, prompting fresh calls for the government to urgently introduce safe routes for asylum seekers to prevent further tragedies. As the search for survivors continued, anger quickly switched to the Home Office's reluctance to introduce measures that would deter migrants from risking their lives crossing the world's busiest shipping lane. The tragedy also created a dreadful ending for Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's Small Boats Week, which was meant to reinvigorate his stuttering strategy to tackle channel crossings, but has been repeatedly marred by blunders and humiliation, including the forced evacuation of the BB Stockholm barge and record small boat arrivals. News of the latest tragedy emerged in the early hours of Saturday, 12th of August, when a passing ship raised the alarm that an overloaded boat was in difficulty off the coast of Saint-Gat near Calais in France. In the hours that followed, British and French coast guards rescued about 65 people from the vessel. France's maritime prefecture of the Channel and the North Sea said it believed two were possibly still missing at sea. Of those rescued, six were recovered in a serious condition, one of whom was flown by helicopter to a Calais hospital and later died in hospital. The remaining five were taken on a boat but subsequently died. Reports from the French lifeboats arriving at the scene described numerous people in the area, many screaming for help. The Dover lifeboat quickly joined the rescue operation, with 10 survivors later seen being brought off the vessel as it returned to Kent, some on stretchers, though the extent of the injuries and exact numbers remained unclear. Enver Solomon, chief executive of the Refugee Council, said the latest preventable deaths underline the need for the Home Office to act. These tragic incidents can and must be prevented. We know that people risk their lives to cross the English Channel as a direct consequence of safe routes being so limited and so ineffective. But instead of putting in place these routes and treating those seeking refuge with compassion and fairness, the government has introduced draconian and unworkable new laws that slams our door in the face of vulnerable men, women and children. Steve Smith, the chief executive of refugee charity Care for Calais, said the terrible loss of life demonstrates yet again the need for a system of safe passage to the United Kingdom for refugees. Later, the charity Freedom from Torture released a statement accusing ministers of hostile attitudes towards refugees. The current Home Office position pledges to bring in new routes, yet it is unclear when and in what form it would do so. We are committed to providing routes, including exploring new routes to safety for vulnerable people crossing the globe. But we must first grip the rise in illegal migration and stop the boats, says the Home Office's website. Following Saturday's tragedy, a statement from the Home Office focused on tackling people smugglers rather than reviewing its current approach. This incident is sadly another reminder of the extreme dangers of crossing the English Channel in small boats and how vital it is that we break the people smugglers' business model and stop the boats, the website said. Britain's Home Secretary Suella Braverman chaired a meeting with Border Force officials on Saturday morning, 12th of August, and described the incident as a tragic loss of life. In France, an investigation has been opened by the Boulogne Prosecutor's Office. The French National Assembly member for Calais, Pierre-Henri Dumont, said authorities were interviewing the migrants who were able to speak and not too unwell to establish what had happened and where they had come from. On Saturday night, rescuers were still scouring the water for survivors and bodies. A French Navy aircraft and a helicopter had been deployed to help in the search. On Thursday, 755 people crossed the English Channel in small boats, the highest daily number so far this year, taking the total since 2018 past 100,000. Rescue crews said it was the seventh time last week that they had had to pull people from the water. Although the incident happened in French territory, it is normal for British and French rescue teams to work together to save as many people as possible. The sinking came just a day after fresh Home Office humiliation, when asylum seekers on the BB Stockholm barge were evacuated following the discovery of Legionella bacteria in the water supply. The worst channel sinking involving migrants occurred in November of 2021, when at least 27 people died after a dinghy sank whilst heading to the United Kingdom from France. Four people died at sea while trying to cross the English Channel in December. The Home Office's position on safe and legal routes also says, as the illegal migration bill sets out, an annual number of people coming through on safe and legal routes will be set by Parliament and in consultation with local authorities. The London Evening Standard has also covered the same story. At least six people have died and more than 50 others rescued when a boat carrying migrants sank in the English Channel. British and French crews have been involved in the large-scale operation after a vessel got into difficulty off the coast of Saint-Gat near Calais in France on Saturday morning, 12th of August. Around 65 people are thought to have boarded the boat, with two possibly still missing at sea, France's Maritime Prefecture of the Channel and the North Sea said. Six were recovered in a serious condition, one of whom was flown by helicopter to a Calais hospital and later was declared dead. An updated statement said the other five individuals who were taken in by boat had also died. A passing ship first raised the alarm that a vessel was sinking near Calais in the early hours of Saturday morning, 12th of August, the prefecture said. Some 22 people were rescued and dropped off in Dover, Kent, including by a Royal National Lifeboat Institution crew, which was launched shortly before 4 a.m. on Saturday, and a British chartered ship. At least 36 other survivors were collected by French boats and taken to the port of Calais, as well as five people who died. Home Secretary Suella Braverman chaired a meeting with Border Force officials later on Saturday morning, 12th of August, describing the incident as a tragic loss of life. Suella Braverman is being updated on latest developments in the operation. A British government spokesperson said these deaths are devastating and our thoughts are with the victims' families and friends at this time. The incident is sadly another reminder of the extreme dangers of crossing the English Channel in small boats and how vital it is that we break the people smugglers' business model and stop the boats. Rescue teams from Folkestone and Langdon Bay, also, along with paramedics from South East Coast Ambulance Service, have also been sent to respond, the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency has confirmed. A French Navy aircraft and helicopter has been deployed, assisted by a number of boats and merchant vessels, a British chartered ship, and the British Coast Guard. An investigation has also been opened by the Boulogne Prosecutor's Office. It comes after 755 people crossed the English Channel in small boats on Thursday, the highest daily number so far this year, confirming the total since 2018 has surpassed 100,000. Some 343 people in six boats were detected crossing the Channel on Friday, according to Home Office figures.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
In this episode, we invite you to listen to the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in a meeting with the Supreme Assembly of Commanders and Officials of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, IRGC, on August 17, 2023. In the Imam Khomeini Husseiniya. The enemy wishes to interfere in the country's security. It wishes to disrupt people's lives. That is what the enemy is doing. Well, the main perpetrators are, of course, the CIA, Mossad, MI6, and the other spy agencies. They are the main perpetrators. But they also have underlinings inside and outside the country who are Western-oriented or are indifferent. But the spy services are the main perpetrators and they are the ringleaders. Our duty today is to continuously safeguard the revolution. Our duty today is to maintain national unity. National unity is important. Our duty today is to encourage people to participate in things. We need to help people. especially the lower classes. Our officials have a duty today to engage in jihadi work. This is not limited to the IRGC. All of the country's officials have a duty to take part in jihadi work. They need to work tirelessly around the clock. We have passed through a large part of this chapter. We have climbed up this steep incline and passed the steepest part, and we are approaching the mountaintop. We must not get tired.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Today is not the day to be tired. It is not the day to give up hope. Today is a day for enthusiasm, hope, and movement. The country's officials in different departments should move forward with this kind of spirit. There should be trust. I'm not saying there should not be criticism. Criticism should exist alongside trust. It's all right if the people want to criticize, but there should also be trust. Our officials are working hard. They are working with sincerity, with interest, with enthusiasm, with all the might, and with trust in Allah. They need to be trusted and criticized if necessary. I'm not opposed to criticism. If you follow this path, and thank God it has pursued up until today and will continue to be followed by God's grace, then victory over the enemy is certain. May God's blessings, greetings, mercy be upon you all.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Thursdays.
In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power.